we will be hopefully in a circle group discussing how student pollution came about to be the one of the central points of the new proposed social statement of the ELCA. And I don't know how many of you have seen this, but it's the Caring for Creation, Vision, Hope, and Justice. And I can't think of a better forum than Holden to start discussing what might become a church-wide statement for, and with sin and pollution being this, seems to be a central part, but that's my own vision of it. And I'll read verbatim, not little portions of it, to get the beginnings of it. For example, the caring for creation all the way through our place in creation, the urgency of it, up through that portion, and then we'll stop, and because I want to make sure that we have enough time to, they tell you how to do, how we can achieve all these things, and other people can read this, and I'd be glad to hand it to anybody to read. But I want to make sure that the underpinnings of it are something that we can agree upon. And if not, that we react to, in some way, to the, I have the addresses here and all, that you can react to the Job Ebenezer and the and people like him, to make sure that this gets heard, so that this statement is in tune with what more people believe in about creation. I'm going to start, for the sake of discussion, at Exodus. One of the more clear examples of sin, then pollution. And where I'm going from here is Exodus 7. This is the famous session, which is not only known to Christians, but it's known to everybody because of obviously movies and things like that, where the Lord said to Moses about Pharaoh. Pharaoh's heart is hardened. He refuses to let the people go. Go out to the water, wait for him by the river's brink, and take in your hand the rod which was turned into a serpent. And you shall say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you, saying, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness, and behold, you have not yet obeyed. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will strike the water that is in the Nile, and with the rod that is in my hand, and it shall be turned to blood, and the fish in the Nile shall die, and the Nile shall become foul, and the Egyptians will loathe to drink water from the Nile. And this is one of the more known passages about sin and pollution. The one of Moses being told to strike the water because of the sins of Pharaoh. And then the sins of Pharaoh, or the leader, are visited upon the people. Clearly, there are a lot more passages in the Bible about pollution. And this is only one aspect of it. The thing I'd like to open up to people at this point is, what is your viewpoint? Where do you feel, or what are the various viewpoints that you feel are important in viewing how are sin and pollution linked? What do those terms mean, and how do they fit in with an environmental viewpoint and a spiritual viewpoint? And where do those mesh? Because I don't want to just take portions out of the Bible and say, see, that shows that it's environment. I want to get a variety of viewpoints on what is sin and pollution. Are they linked? Are they linkable? And when are they? What do they mean? And I can start with anybody.
It seems to me that sin and pollution are inextricably linked insofar as sin involves separation from God in some fashion, and sin is life-destroying in some fashion. And pollution is almost by definition a life-degrading process. It degrades the quality of life rather than enhances it.
Okay, let me see if if I got this correct, your sin as turning away from God, and I believe your definition of pollution, therefore, is not the pollution by sin, but in effect, other pollution that results, such as fouling of waters and things like that. Is that?
I think we can leave it right there for the moment, yeah.
Okay, because there are other definitions of what people believe pollution is. People believe that one can pollute one's own body.
Well, I think of pollution being linked many times to greed. Just take what I can get, don't worry about the consequences, because I or we can make a profit on this.
So one is turning away from God, and one is selfishly turning to one's own self-made desires or whatever.
Right.
Okay.
It's a disregard for the, I'm not finding the word, but for the unity of, I was reading Chief Seattle yesterday and how we are all one with the earth, and it's a disregard of that. We tend to separate ourselves from the earth.
Would you like to hear that? Would everybody like to hear what Chief Seattle said? I have that phrase, and I think it might be helpful in terms of describing the feeling you have, because I'm not sure everybody's familiar with what Chief Seattle said. This is in 1854. This is a very good book, Creation in Crisis. The reason I didn't want to just tell the bookstore to get one book, because I have a resource list, and I prefer people make their own choices later. But in the letter for Chief Seattle, he writes to the federal government saying, this was from the Sasquamish tribe in Washington territory. So, the great chief from Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land. The great chief also sends us words of friendship and goodwill. This is kind of him, since we know he had little need of our friendship in return. But we will consider your offer. But we know that if we do not sell, the white man may come with guns and take our land. How can you buy yourself the sky, the warmth of land? The idea is strange to us. If we do not own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, how can you buy them? Every part of this earth is sacred to my people. Every shiny pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark woods, every clearing and humming insect is wholly in the memory and experience of my people. The sap which courses through the trees carries the memory of the red man. The white man's dead forget the country of their birth when they go to walk among the stars. Our dead never forget this beautiful earth, for it is the mother of the red man. We are part of the earth and it is part of us. The perfumed flowers are our sisters, the deer, the horse, the great eagle, these are our brothers. The rocky crest, the juices in the meadows, the body, people, the pony, and man all belong to the same family. So when the great chief from Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land, he asks much of us. When the great chief sends word he will reserve us a place so that we can live comfortably to ourselves, he will be father and we will be his fathers and we will be his children. So you will consider your offer to buy our land, but it will not be easy, for this land is sacred to us. The shining water that moves in the streams and the rivers is not just water, but the blood of our ancestors. If we sell you land, you must remember that it's sacred, and you must teach your children that it's sacred. That each ghostly reflection in the clear water of the lake tells of events and memories in the life of my people. The water's murmur is the voice of my father's father. And it does go on if I might go a little further. There is no quiet place in the white man's cities, no place to hear the unfurling of leaves in spring or the rustle of insects' wings. And it goes to a point, so you must teach your children that the ground beneath their feet is the ashes of our grandfathers. And another place, but you, in your perishing, you will shine brightly, fired by the strength of the God who brought you to the land, and for some special purpose gave you dominion over this land and over the red man. This destiny is a mystery to us. We do not understand when the buffalo are all slaughtered, the white wild horses are tamed, the secret corners of the forest heavy with the scent of many men, and the view of the ripe hill blotted by talking wires. Where is the thicket gone? Where is the eagle gone? What is to say, and what is to say goodbye to the swift pony in the hunt? The end of living and the beginning of survival. And then it goes on, the ending. We think we know our God is the same God. The earth is precious to him. Even the white man cannot be exempt from the common destiny. We may be brothers after all. We shall see. What from that, what the unity of people and unity of people with the land, is that?
The relationship that we have and okay. almost a symbiotic kind of relationship that man and woman and humanity has with the earth and reciprocity.
And so if we lose that, that's where pollution comes from. So sin can be turning away from God, sin can be selfish greed, and sin can be lost relationship, whether it be relationship with other humans or relationship between humanity and the earth. Okay. Any other?
If you have to know what, or want to know what pollution is, I'd like to hear or understand what it would be without pollution. You know, what's the idea? I don't know if you're going to get to that. You know, or do we go back to the garden picture?
To what is the earth without pollution? Well, I think that does beg the question, what is pollution then? Mm-hmm. This morning, most of you were not at the session.
Bible study?
The Bible study, right. And he talked from Genesis about a balance. And then we fall out of balance, perhaps, in my mind, that's where pollution starts. Because if we look within our own bodies, in our own bodies, I teach a course in physiology, and we call it homeostasis when we're in balance with our own bodies. When we fall too far out of balance, when waste builds up, or we call one part more important than the other, then we fall out of balance within our own bodies. And we go out of homeostasis, and we get heat stroke and all sorts of things. If we fall out of balance in our own bodies, then we can take it outside of that. We have a balance with our environment. Certain levels are tolerable to all life, and there need to be fluctuations in natural levels of certain chemicals and other things, and that may not be pollution, but when we fall out of that balance, it certainly is. And the question is, what is natural versus what is human-derived? I mean, natural pollution comes from volcanoes and other sources, and we know they can be devastating initially.
Well, humans are natural.
Yes. Okay. Does a volcano have a choice to erupt or not?
There we inject the human element in nature, but that deals with some pretty profound things. Yeah. That's what you're doing.
Sin is a choice, right?
What is the balance? It's a static symbiosis, I would guess.
Okay.
But
I'd like to hear him out. I want to make sure he gets fully heard here.
Well, I read an article years ago about the symbiosis of the cell. Mm-hmm. We talk about biologically the cell is a unit entity, a self-contained entity. Mm-hmm. Yet this article took each segment of the cell and explained that it was a entity within itself.
But
mm-hmm. in arguments we considered them the basic building block of
so we have the cell has to work together.
Yeah.
The various portions have to work together, otherwise it doesn't work. So basically, pollution and sin is when things don't work together anymore, or there's a choice not to work together, but rather to work toward the end of one part or other, and we fall out of symbiosis.
Or to causes other than man's choice, sinful choices, whatever throws that symbiosis out of balance, the volcano.
Okay. Thank you.
But the symbiosis has to have some flexibility for adaptation, for change.
You wanted to interject.
I think that any group of human beings, no matter how small and no matter how careful, whatever that may mean, in some fashion or other alters their environment. Mm-hmm. We have no choice. I mean, all living creatures alter their environment in some fashion. Mm-hmm. I think it becomes pollution when the consequences of the altering of that environment are not acknowledged or accepted or dealt with.
Or will they inject an imbalance in the symbiosis that has not occurred before? I don't mean to put words in your mouth, just perhaps building on that.
If I might interject a point, we are the only animal that is capable of determining if something is sinful or not, if something is pollution or not. No other animal, no other part of the creation, whether it be the erupting volcano, the massive earthquake, or anything like that, has the power or the ability to change itself.
Well, we have a very imperfect detection system. What's evil? What's sin?
But it's, you know, we're the only ones that can draw a line.
I agree, but we err in deciding what's sinful.
Right.
Okay, so basically sinfulness, I think we all agree here, I hear a commonality that sin is a choice. We're not sure what choice. And we know it's pollution. We can all agree it's pollution when it gets out of hand. That things get so awry that us and a whole lot of other things aren't able to live. We know that's pollution. The Bible gets more than that. I mean, it says we pollute ourselves when we commit sin. Mm-hmm. That we somehow stain ourselves, and that, as a result, makes us capable of certain things.
But again, it's our choice.
Okay. But I'm saying that the Bible links into the pollution definition.
But even if we are polluting within ourselves, it's our choice to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we are the only animal that has the choice or the ability to choose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we can pollute others, other humans, as well as other
species.
As other species and other things. And it doesn't have to be a chemical pollution. We can oppress another, and that is a form of pollution. Mm-hmm. And hasn't that in the past led to pollution, I mean, in effect? When we keep people in horrible land and tell them you have to live there, they then create even worse environmental destruction by, you know, having to burn trees and other things. So we have a few definitions there. Now, I'd like to start with that group starting point before we read this document. Because this is the church as group. This is the ELCA proposed social statement for the 1993 Churchwide Assembly of the ELCA. It's a draft statement which has already been approved by the Board of Division for Church and Society on March 6, 1993, with the intent that it be the basis for education and action among members and throughout the entire Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And it's called Caring for Creation, Vision, Hope, and Justice. And what I'd like to go through is just the initial portions, because I'd like to go through the foundation portion. We don't have to go through the action portions, because we will be going in the rest of the week, we'll be going through things of advocacy, etc. But at the beginning, I'd like to at least get through the basis for the statement and see if people have other viewpoints of it or whether it meets with the group's sense of what sin and pollution are, and is that a basis for the following statement. The prologue reads, Christian concern for the environment is shaped by the Word of God spoken in creation, the love of God hanging on a cross, the breath of God daily renewing the face of the earth. We of the ELCA are deeply concerned about the environment locally and globally, as members of a church and as members of society. Even as we join the political, economic, and scientific discussion, we know care for the earth to be a profound spiritual matter. As Lutheran Christians, we confess that both our witness to God's goodness in creation and our acceptance of caregiving responsibility have often been weak and uncertain. This statement, in the name of an asterisk, offers a vision of God's intention for creation, for humanity as creation's caregivers. Another asterisk acknowledges humanity's separation from God and from the rest of creation as the central cause of the environmental crisis. Asterisk recognizes the severity of the crisis. Asterisk expresses hope and heed to the call to justice and commitment. This statement summons us in particular to a faithful return to the biblical vision. Does that fit the sort of prologue of where we're heading in terms of, or should I continue through the church's vision of creation?
I think it made a whole lot of assumptions that we didn't make here that we tended to explicate much more specifically.
Okay.
And they just kind of assumed a whole string of things.
Mm-hmm.
That we, I'm not sure we're assumable necessarily.
Which point would you say that? Would you say, for example, acknowledges humanity's separation from God and the rest of creation as the central cause of the environmental crisis?
Yeah. Yeah, it made no linkage there, it simply assumed it.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first asterisk?
Offens a vision of God's intention for creation of humanity as creation's caregivers. Which is pretty much a summation of the Genesis account. The dominion being caretaking.
But again, not defined, simply assumed in an undefined fashion.
And then they talk about returning to the biblical vision.
Which is, again, not...
again, it's not entirely clear. That's why
I'll
go into the next section just to see if it's covered, and then we'll go back on it, because, and frankly, this is the kind of document that's necessary to comment back on or to work with. I mean, if it comes to your church, for example...
For a vote.
Or not even for a vote, for action. How would you utilize this document knowing it's... Yes?
There's one inherent problem, and it really didn't become real for me until I started reading Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one cynical character in there that talks about the fact that if the world ended today as humans know it, mm-hmm. the Earth would continue on. And the Earth would survive.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem that I see so many times is we put so much emphasis on the fact of the humans as the controllers of the Earth. Hey, if you go along with the geological time schedule, we've been here for less than a minute in a 12-hour time clock.
Mm-hmm. What about less than a second?
Less than a second, okay. But looking at it from that aspect, we hold ourselves so all-powerful and so all-knowing and so all-wonderful, and we are so blatantly infinitesimal.
Yeah, the phrase about that we are creation's caregivers. Not so sure about that, sounds like.
So creation is capable of taking care of itself. For example, dinosaurs were shrugged off this earth 100 million years ago, and we don't seem to know the difference other than they were here at some point.
Was there balance then?
I don't...
Was there pollution then? Before there were human beings, was there a thing called balance when you had these enormous geological...
Nature can pollute this earth much more effectively than mankind can. Mount Pinatubo put, you know...
But the situation... Out of nature's pollution, the destruction, it's simply of a destruction of what is there, but something else comes in place of it. Where when man goes at it, you know, basically, you have a total elimination of. I think we give ourselves so much power that we don't have. We're so tied up with ourselves.
I think, though, that I think maybe the words they're using are wrong. Because what I had always learned was the word of stewardship. That Genesis recognized that man had great potential for creativity and destruction. And we were asked to be stewards of creation. Not caretakers, but stewards. And to me, that means you use what's been given to you wisely.
Okay.
You use the animals, you use the minerals, you use the air and the water wisely.
Okay, dominion, but what does dominion mean? Is that the original word? What is it? Because sometimes we have to go back to the Hebrew to find out what it means. Caretaking, that sort of thing is...
The Good News Bible I opened this morning at that study said power over, which is more than the dominion thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that. That's
but I think we, if we go to back to the original roots, I think there is a more sense of care, giving, care, taking. A caretaker is a steward.
That's what I, yeah, I think that's the word that I'm comfortable with, though. It's the word that I understand. It's the word that we use a lot. But isn't that what Genesis is telling us? It says, you have control. You can decide. Please decide wisely.
But isn't it a caretaker? Isn't that somebody, don't you, I picture a caretaker, somebody who's given over a house or a cemetery to look after, mm-hmm. till the owner comes back.
Okay. So, but we also have the power. We were speaking that we don't have power. I think we have extraordinary power.
Okay. So we have we're caretakers who have lots of power, even if over geologic time, it seems like we're infinitesimal. We're capable of a lot in a very short period of time.
Well, Genesis came out of, how you want to assume Genesis, the words were created and the ideas were put down. It was created at the end of a period of geologic history. Mm-hmm. I mean, it didn't, obviously.
Well, consider this.
The word in Hebrew for dominion very definitely has the connotations of rule. And the word power is not totally out of line, although I don't like to use it in today's situation. The problem is that you have to look at the fact that human beings are created in the image of God mm-hmm. and given the task, okay? And that brings you back to the image of God. And if you don't make that connection there, that's when you get into trouble. Mm-hmm. God has a way of dealing with creation, mm-hmm. and human beings are to deal with it that way. And when we fail to do that, when we take our own idea of what dominion means, and that's where 1 Samuel 8 teaches us how human beings take the concept of dominion and use it to dominate, mm-hmm. which is improper. The kings of Israel are always supposed to be predicated upon the kingship of God. They never are. And that's why Jesus becomes the only king. Okay, he's the only one who holds power appropriately. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't do with his power what human beings do with power. Mm-hmm. And that you come back to Genesis. We are to use our power the way God uses power to care for creation and the stewardship ideas.
So we have some gifts. We have some gifts that were given by God and abilities to utilize those gifts. And that's a power of caretaking. Mm-hmm. That's the sense I'm getting. Okay. I'd like to come to your point.
Well, image of God, I'm glad to hear that because God is the Spirit. As a paleontologist, I look at the development of biological being, of life, mm-hmm. starting from 3 billion year old bacteria. Mm-hmm. When I was a student 50 years ago, all life began in the Cambrian, which is 600 million years ago. Mm-hmm. There was no evidence of life before that. Techniques and knowledge have developed and have discovered the bacterial fossils preceding that. And subsequently, every age, every period of time has seen development of life forms into higher and higher, more complicated, multicellular entities. And where are we? Just like Genesis says, he created mankind. Now, physically, we're the end point, present time, and then we inject this spiritual thing in an image of God. But to me, it certainly doesn't negate our stewardship. It's just the linear entity there of biological life is we're God's crowning achievement, and in addition to the physical complexities and mental circuitry in our brain, he's given us the spiritual dimension there to handle his power.
So you see it as a process. We're part of a process of creation that continues on. And we're what we think is the crowning achievement.
Well, there may be some further behind that.
If we go to Genesis this morning, I just wanted to throw this out for discussion. We put the sixth day as really up there. Humans were made. Yay, that's it. God did well. Then there's a seventh day. And that's what was brought up this morning, the seventh day being Sabbath, Shabbat. That was the Sabbath, the crowning achievement, and everything precedes it feeds into Shabbat, Shalom. Shabbat Shalom being the greeting of Jews to each other on Shabbat. The peace of Shabbat is the symbiosis, the relationship, the, I heard a lot of good terms out here that fitted the stewardship, the everything that goes into everything working as good in God's kingdom. So that seems to be, sounds like, well, that's what people find is missing here, that they don't have some specifics. Yeah.
There'd be no argumentation. Mm-hmm. There'd be no argumentation about power, mm-hmm. dominion, dominate, control. There would be no argument about any of these things. And then out of World War II and the cynicism about the wars end all wars, and the Second World comes in, and there's a new prevailing fashion that man is the worst. Boy, man, you know, we did it. We're terrible. By George, we're not the crown of creation. So we have a Bible study that says, oh, the apex in Genesis 1, in the first chapter, is the seventh day, not the sixth day. Mm-hmm. And there's twice as many Bible verses about the sixth day, you know, mm-hmm. and there's twice as much explanation and description of it in detail, but we kind of ignore all of that because it's part of this cultural, man's the problem, human being is the problem. And we start out on this document reflecting that same kind of, human beings are just the cause of everything evil. But I think sometimes we don't step back and realize how much our given thought for this decade is fashionable. It's what's kind of acceptable right now. And I would say that document reflects that point of view. We're the problem, we're the cause. It's kind of an anti-negative statement about human beings. Pardon?
What would you like to see it? I mean, if put it in a positive way, where obviously God stops each point and says, that is good. That is very good. That is good. So everything, God doesn't...
Including human beings.
Right.
And he gets done with human beings, and he says, and they're good. Right. And then the next statement, and when he finished everything, it was very good, comes right after the sixth day. And it wasn't like human beings are now responsible solely for the deterioration of the earth. No, somebody said it's kind of like an overemphasis on human beings and our role on this creation cosmos. All we have to do is have one giant meteorite come and blast this planet Earth of ours, and everything will get shifted again real quickly. We are really small in terms of the significance of time and history. And so my argument with that document, I really believe that we need to write documents about care of the Earth, you know, but you just... you get a little tired of this. It's our, oh, human beings, we're just awful. Look what we have done.
What would you rewrite it? I'd like to hear, you know, and it doesn't have to be perfect. Just what kind of statement would you think would be beneficial to see at the beginning of a doctrine of caregiving? Acknowledging the sins that we have done, that have had impact, that we, in a sense, need the forgiveness of those creatures, etc., who we have affected, including our own fellow human beings, who we have negatively affected, so that we may gain redemptive power to turn away from that, but in a positive way. How would you put that without covering over? I mean, I don't want any covering over and say, well, humans have been just simply marvelous during all these centuries. And every time we read the Bible, we read the times when human beings weren't terribly marvelous. And terrible things did happen. So how do we fit that within a biblical framework?
I guess if I were going to start it off, I would have something that acknowledges human beings' cooperation with God. I mean, in terms of, look at the marvelous thing that this planet, in terms of feeding billions upon billions of people, we've had a marvelous partnership. With the creative, there's nothing in there that acknowledges that this, you may have liked to live 100 years ago on this planet Earth, but I would much rather live today, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. And it has, with all those diseases 100 years ago, there's nothing in there that acknowledges human beings and how we've controlled the diseases. There's nothing that acknowledges that. Mm-hmm. There's been enormous progress for civilization during the history of the human race. There's nothing that talks about that.
Okay.
Things like that.
So you'd like to see something like God created all creation as a good, and that human beings have, at times, as sinful moments, times of great devotion to a common good, participate in God's creative effort. However, we do acknowledge our sins that have resulted in some of the problems of pollution, etc., that we see now, and seek God's redemptive power to move us forward in another positive effort of redeeming ourselves and in our environment. Is that?
As soon as I hear that stuff, I know when it was written, that's all. Just like when you read a piece of literature, you kind of pick out a genre. You know a time in history. You read that document, and it comes from a time in history.
Well,
that's appropriate, too.
And the other thing that we need to be looking at is if we tell people they're negative, they're bad, and there's no good in them, then they do become depressed and cynical, and we can't do anything, and it's hopeless, and we lose the redeeming nature. So some positive statement affirming our relationship with God.
In the creation order. Well, everybody I know would rather live today rather than in this fantasy idealism of 100 years ago when diseases were rampant and the lifespan is half as lengthened as it is today.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, do you see that document pushing living 100 years ago?
No.
Okay, let's go forward in it, because we just did the prologue. I just want to read some of the rest of this. I know we don't have much time, but I want to at least get through the initial stages so we can see what their basis is. We see the spoiling of the environment as nothing less than degradation of God's gracious gift of creation. Scripture witnesses to God as creator of the earth and all that dwells therein. Psalms 24:1. The creeds which guide our reading of Scripture proclaim God the Father, Jesus Christ, as maker of heaven and earth. Jesus Christ is the one through whom all things were made, and the Holy Spirit as the Lord, the giver of life, Nicene Creed. God blesses the world and sees it as good, even before humankind comes on the scene. All creation, not just humankind, is viewed as very good in God's eyes, so we have some of that positive. God continues to bless the world. When you send forth your Spirit, they are created and renew the face of the ground. Psalms 104:30. By faith, we understand God to be deeply, mysteriously, and unceasingly involved in what happens in all creation. God showers care upon sparrows and lilies, Matthew 6, and brings rain on a land where no one lives, on the desert, which is empty of human life, Job 38:26. Central to our vision of God's profound involvement with the world is the incarnation. In Christ, the Word is made flesh with saving significance for an entire creation that longs for fulfillment. Romans. The Word still comes to us in the waters of baptism and in with and under the bread and wine, fruits of the earth and the work of human hands. God consistently meets us where we live through earthly matter. It sounds a little more positive in that vein. I think we have a little more positive. Our place in creation, humanity is intimately related to the rest of creation. We, like other creatures, are formed from the earth, Genesis. Scripture speaks of humanity's kinship with other creatures, and Psalms and Job. God cares faithfully for us, and together we join in the singing, the hymn of all creation, Lutheran Book of Worship. We look forward to a redemption that includes all creation, and that's from Ephesians. Humans in service to God have special roles on behalf of the whole of creation. Made in the image of God, we are called to care for the earth as God cares for the earth. God's command to have dominion and subdue the earth is not a license to dominate and exploit. Human domination, a special responsibility, should reflect God's way of ruling as a shepherd king who takes the form of servant wearing a crown of thorns. According to Genesis 2:15, our role within creation is to serve and to keep God's garden, the earth. To serve, also translated to till, invites us again to envision ourselves as servants, while to keep invites us to care of the earth as God keeps and cares for us. We are called to name the animals, as God named Israel and all creation, and as the shepherd calls by name each sheep Naming unites us in a caring relationship. Further, we are to live within the covenant God made with every living thing, and even with the day and night, we are to love the earth as God loves us. We are called to live according to God's wisdom in creation, which brings together God's truth and goodness. Wisdom, God's way of governing creation, is discerned in every culture and era in various ways. In our time, science and technology can help us to discover how to live according to God's creative wisdom. And we have a couple of people who mentioned that. Such caring, serving, keeping, loving, and living out by wisdom sum up what is meant by God, by acting as God's steward of the earth. God's gift and responsibility for the earth dignifies humanity without debasing the rest of creation. We depend upon God who places us in the web of life with one another and with all creation. And not much longer, I have only the urgency, which is not very long, and then we can stop and talk. Not content to be the image of God, we have rebelled and disrupted creation, and through the people of ancient Israel, we experienced nature as an instrument of God's judgment. It disrupted nature as a judgment on our unfaithfulness and stewards, alienated from God, from creation, and driven to make a name for ourselves. We become captives to demonic powers and unjust institutions. In our captivity, we treat the earth as a boundless warehouse and all allow the powerful to exploit its boundaries to their own good. And that's from Amos. Our sin and captivity lie at the roots of the current crisis. And then it goes into the current crisis and the things we have done. So that is some of the basis, that's some of the basis of where they're coming at with the statement. There was a lot there. What do you think would be essential that may not be included in that statement, or what do you think is essential in that statement that's already included? Either way, yes.
Well, I was saying about overpopulation there.
Mm-hmm.
Something I hear.
Okay, that's something specific that I think is addressed later on. Let's see. I'll have to take a look whether it's here. And you're free to look at the document as well.
And the part about sin and pollution, how much for that connects?
Okay. What you mean sin and pollution don't connect? And could you explain where it might not connect?
Well, I mean, as it's intended to toss trash in the street,
mm-hmm.
Or is it a sin? The fact that we have too much garbage each week to throw out. Is it a sin? I don't know. How do you define sin? That doesn't sound like to me a particularly religious approach.
In other words, you feel there's some practical things on earth that aren't overly sinful in terms of being a big, in capital letters, sin, and maybe polluting.
Yeah. Okay. The sin does not. I mean, what's the main? Doesn't make sense.
Okay.
How do you define sin? How do you define sin?
We have all kinds of historical sins. There's original sin down through all the personal sins. But this, in terms of this being a sin, somebody tells some of their sinning. Because it's from the garbage in the street, somehow does not relate to all the things that I've heard about sin. You can tell me more. It's different.
I guess I've got to go back to Ed's statement. And Ed's statement was that everything was good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the thing that we have to keep in mind is that the human fiasco in the Garden of Eden. And from that point on, I don't often hear in the Bible as I read or as people talk about God saying that the earth was good. Prior to the human fiasco in the Garden of Eden, things were good. After that, I'm sorry, we messed it up.
Yeah, I kind of wish Ed hadn't left. I never got a chance to I thought I had a couple of things to say to rebut, but anyways.
You still do that. I mean,
well, I can, I'll corner him later, no question. But, you know, I guess, you know, I would really like to study the document. As Canadians, we haven't produced a document quite like that yet. We've produced a couple of short pieces, but nothing that long.
In fact, why don't you take this, and anybody can pass it around. I'm in Chalet 11. Whenever everybody's done with it, they can pass it back to me and take as much time as you need on it.
I think that in spite of what you and Ed were saying about the infinitesimalness of humans in terms of our over the span of time, and I certainly have no quarrel with that, there is something very unique about our sheer numbers and our technological ability that quite literally does give us the opportunity to sterilize this earth or to make it. We don't quite have the ability to destroy it utterly, but we certainly have the ability to sterilize it, which may not be a whole lot distinctive. And
that's all the nuclear power that could was in a very.
Oh, I mean, when I meant destroy it, I meant literally to fragment it to the point of disappearance. We're working on that. That'll be next year, right?
The Earth as we know it, as we expect it. I mean,
well, destruction of life on the surface.
Yeah. Destruction, yeah, the sterilization part is, you know, that's
we can do that.
We can do that several times over. Mm-hmm.
But then again, that's if everything that we think we've put together works. Also, well, but that's a whole
for somehow, for some reason, our instruments of destruction tend to work extraordinarily well.
That's true. Well, but we're assuming that God will allow those instruments to destruct.
I think God will allow us the consequences of our behavior.
Well,
he has all down the line.
God allows the galaxy to be destroyed. I don't know what to.
But wait a second, we're getting away from what God's call is to us immediately.
Yeah.
We've seen, if we put ourselves in the infinitesimalness of time, we can allow ourselves to do anything.
Yep.
Because it won't be any different.
Yep.
But Jesus came to people, we're going to die the next day. You know, lepers who possibly could die. And he didn't bring everybody back from the dead. He brought a few back, but he cried with others. He was with people because he felt every second of their life was valuable and a time of redemptive action could occur at that point. That just because we're just here for a short time doesn't make each second that much valuable to each individual creature and person. So if we put ourselves in all the good we've done, and no matter what bad we do, the earth will recover, the bad we do, the sins we do, will pollute that other person or that other creature, and that other creature will suffer for it. Or even if it suffers for a second, God tells us that we should go and comfort that second for that creature. Hold it for that last second.
Even the trash in the street that somehow turns to what kind of bacteria that could make some little kid sick, you know, by picking it up.
A six-pack can.
It can be a...
The six-pack pop?
Mm-hmm.
We could just throw that out, and let's say it blows into a lake. The fish have been caught in those and died.
Don't teach your trash to swim.
And some of that, yes, we're in the infinitesimalness of time. But if we get too caught up in this, what we're capable of, and we can destroy the whole earth, and the earth will recover and all that, we lose sight. We have no idea why the dinosaurs are gone. Okay?
Not true.
No, I mean, the reason they're gone, not
how they disappear. Yeah.
What if dinosaurs were one of the first parts of creation and God watched how they were evolving and say, no good, here's a meteor. Now, I don't know that. That's not explained in Genesis. But he could just as well send a meteor and say, well, that was a good experiment, but here we go. And we'll wait for the next evolutionary form to make. Do we want that to happen? Do we want another Bible to develop with the next creatures being the ultimate creation of God?
But yet, part of the problem that I have with that is we have placed ourselves, and the Bible sets it also, as the only individuals that have souls.
Okay.
If you go back to Indian culture, to many of the other cultures, all things have an entity that will continue on.
Mm-hmm.
It is only the human's concept of the Bible where we come out and say, we're the only ones that have souls, we're the only ones that are going to be saved.
Now that's a derivative kind of thing. It is what you don't find in the Bible is a concrete discussion of other things with souls.
Okay.
But all living things, especially in the Old Testament, soul is nefesh. It isn't there after death. It is what activates the person. And without your soul, the person does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
And when the person dies, there is no concept in the Old Testament of the nefesh flaking off to God. What happens is we brought something into the Greek, into the New Testament, and we've imported the immortal soul of the ancient Greeks, which does not exist in the Bible. The soul is not immortal. Okay, there is death, and there is the miracle of resurrection and the promise of resurrection.
But what do we teach?
That's what we do. You're right. Then, because the discussion only concerns human beings, then we say, well, obviously, nothing else has a soul. But that's part of this, humans are the crown of creation, routine two. That is, you know, let's take the idea of dominion that we are all familiar with and let's run with it, which is what we did.
I think, you know, regardless, and I have no trouble with, you know, God wiping us all out and starting over again. I'd rather it didn't happen, okay? But yeah, theologically, I can see that he could choose, God could choose to do this.
He did
kind of keep Noah around.
Yeah.
And whether non-human creatures have souls, whether they're mortal, I think for us right here and now, there is this question of how do I live, and how does my species live in relationship, underlying the word relationship, with everything else, with the volcanoes, with the earthquakes, with the buffalo, the deer, the dogs, and the trash. And that's what we come down to with pollution and sin, it seems to me, is that it becomes sin, it becomes pollution when those relationships are shattered, whether it's me dumping DDT into lakes and rivers, whether it's me throwing trash on the ground that becomes offensive, an eyesore, or a health hazard, or a life hazard to another creature, or whether it is simply the sheer volume of the music I play that is polluting somebody else's air and ears, or whether it is the alcohol I consume that pollutes and destroys my own body and my relationships with my loved ones.
Or overconsumption.
Or the person I may kill driving down the road while drunk. Or my overconsumption of food to the point that, you know, but it's the destruction of that relationship with me and all of life around me.
I think there's a paradox that I struggle with constantly, that sometimes, I'm in the medical field, and sometimes to find the relationship of our being and our personal, every cell, to go back to what you're saying, and how God created every cell, to find that relationship, bring this, I live in Houston, so I'm tuned to the space program, bring the space program into this, the greatest polluter of the environment is the space program. And yet it brings us answers about our relationship to space and the rest of the earth and every force upon our body. So it's almost as though in our search for trying to find the answers to God's, that God poses,
mm-hmm.
we have to almost, or we don't have to, but some, for some reason we are going through this right polluting stance to find the answers. The same thing is true in the medical field when you talk about, when Ed was talking about the course of the diseases, and you wouldn't have wanted to have all these diseases years mm-hmm. ago. Surely we're finding answers to diseases right now in the cancer field, but we also look at how we have wasted the rainforests, where all of the answers
have come from.
Yes, but in our medical search for this, the medical world is the greatest polluter also, but we are now coming back full circle to the plans that God has provided for us. But only through our medical search have we found these answers, and only through the medical search have we
polluted the world in such a manner. It's almost as though it's something that has to be in our search for understanding of God.
I think it's part of that. There's a tension there, and there's maybe more than a tension. It's a conflict that we will always, always have to live with. And the question, we talked about this last night, are we willing to pay the cost? Are we willing, what costs are we willing to pay?
Okay.
You know, what costs are we willing to pay?
I have to draw it into the, just because of time, but I'd just like to give a linkage to that, because next time I will be talking about science and risk assessment, which is how society deals with questions. And then we'll talk about Jesus' call, what his risk assessment. Mm. Risk assessment is a way of statistically figuring out whether a new compound or a mixture of things will affect a human being over a lifetime, or other creatures, or ecosystems, etc. And then saying, this is acceptable to society. What's acceptable to a society, and what can science do, and what can science not do? And what does Jesus say is the ultimate assessment? And even after we make that assessment, how do we carry it out? So any of that is, that's hopefully going to be somewhat linking here. What do we do now? And is it acceptable to us as Christians? Or, and even if it is, how do we react to that one person or, you know, ecosystem or et cetera that is affected? So we need to bring Jesus' call into what society has already set up, whether it be believing in what we've set up and working with that, the consequences of that, according to Jesus saying how we deal with consequences, or establishing a new thing in combination with science, working in Jesus' call, even though that's terribly expensive and things like that in the short run, and finding out what that means for us for the future as well. And so we will hopefully start stirring that into the picture and see how that helps us in the understanding of where we're at, what our assumptions are, and how do we bring the sacred in to help us cope and to give us hope for the future.